work session at this time on pension changes. I'd like to recognize our city manager, John Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and through you to the members of the council. We appreciate this follow-up meeting on the original workshop that we had on the pension. We do have experts in the field of pensions with us. We have Warner Anthony once again, who is our pension attorney, Gary Smith. We have Joel Black from Mulden & Jenkins, our CPA firm. And we have two guests that are on the phone. Ben Upchurch is our actuary from Milliman, and Aaron Schlupp is from Empower, which is a entity that oversees pension administration. And we certainly want to welcome our new council members here today. We knew when we began to talk about long-range financial planning that some issues needed to be addressed. One, of course, being infrastructure, which we spent a good deal of time on. But the other issue is the need for the financial, long-term financial stability of the city, certainly spearheaded by Steve Homoki and others, was the need to look at our pension plan with all of the changes that are happening nationally, not only in the private sector, but the public sector as well. Stated simply, our pension plan is comparatively a generous plan. Not only is it a defined benefit plan, but it is a defined benefit plan that does not require an employee match. These days, that is exceedingly rare in the private sector and beginning to be more and more rare in the public sector. At the same time, we have been cognizant that the financial management of the pension system in Aiken has been exemplary. That we have basically almost a fully funded plan. And we read almost weekly about cities across the country that have only 5 or 10% of the plan funded, that are literally in crisis. That is not the city of Aiken. That's not why we're looking at the pension plan. It has been our recommendation since day one that we look at the possibility of conversion to a defined contribution plan, which is the trend these days. And our recommendation has been very clear since day one, which is that this plan change would impact new employees only, that we have a bond, a pact, a commitment that we've made to our existing employees, and because of the wise financial decision making in the past, we have the luxury of looking at this issue not in a crisis mode but in a long range planning mode, and it is our very strong opinion that our existing employees be grandfathered with the plan that we have, but that new employees after a certain date be required to go into a defined contribution plan. Now, we introduced a resolution to you at the last meeting that was approved, and there were four or five issues that were raised. The purpose of today's meeting is to continue to have that discussion. On page 8 of the agenda, item number 5 is the item that I would like to begin with, which is the effective date. We had originally envisioned requesting the council take action so that we could implement this as of January 1st, 2018. With the complexity of this issue and with the reality that we have three new members of the council, we think that our recommendation to you is that you consider implementing this as of 1 July 2018 and not 1 January 2018. That would give all of us, including the new members of the council, more time to consider the plan, to have their questions answered, and to feel comfortable, which is our goal, before a vote is taken. And so that it will be our recommendation, that we continue to discuss this after today into December. In a perfect world, we would have a vote in January, but it's not necessary, but it would be nice because we will be going into the budget deliberations thereafter. But my point to individual council members has been and continues to be that you should take as much time as you need to feel comfortable taking this vote, because there are long-term ramifications to it, and we want to make sure you understand it and you feel comfortable with it. So if we can do that, if we can answer all your questions today, then so be it. If we need to go into meetings in December and January, so be it. And we need more time, that's okay too. That I speak for our entire staff when I say that this isn't about getting it done quickly, it's about getting it done wisely. And if you need more time, then so be it. So having said that, we do have our panel of experts here to answer any questions that you may have. If you turn to page 6 in the agenda, we begin to discuss the 5 or 6 issues that have been raised. And I'd like to just identify them and then turn it over to our panel to have them explain their rationale for their recommendations. And a lot of these, there's no right answer. There's no right and wrong answer. There is a wide variety of possibilities. The first one on page 6 is eligibility. Who would be eligible for this new program? Should the plan cover part-time employees or just full-time employees? Should it only include those employees that are at least 21 years of age? And should we have a requirement that you need to work for a year before you participate in the pension system? And I'd just like to ask any of the panel that has a thought in that regard, in terms of we're recommending that there be a one-year requirement, and the justification is contained in the notes. But is there anybody in the panel that wants to tackle that issue initially, in terms of a recommendation on who should be eligible? I know Warner was very involved with the drafting of this, but I don't know if you'd like to comment or have others comment.
I'll just say that in the drafting of this, I generally followed the terms of your current pension plan. But and that was the exclusion of part-time employees, age 21, and a year of service, which is what your current plan. I didn't want to change anything from your current plan. But many people, when they move to a DC approach, sometimes expand the number of people. So I just wanted it to be have the council consider what they would want to do in terms of it, whether they want to expand the number of people covered by a defined contribution plan.
And the issue of the 1 year, I know that you had some thoughts about.
While the current plan requires 1 year before you're eligible, the 1 year was very important in this arrangement, so that if we adopted it January 1, 2018, it gave us 12 months to set up the procedures, to hire a record keeper, and to be able to move forward January 1, 2019, when the first contribution is made for anyone hired after January 1, 2018. Now, if you go to less than 1 year, we may have to be, for instance, if you went to a 3 months, some defined contribution plans, particularly that require employee contributions, say, you know, everyone's hired after 3 months they come in. If we did something like that, then we would need to have the record keeper set up ahead of time, and we probably would miss even the July 1, 2019 date, and probably would have to move everything back to January 1, 2019. 2019 in order to have all the procedures in place. The one-year service gives us basically 1 year to get all the procedures in place.
It's a different way. And we set it up, and 1 year was it, and we were comfortable. Is there any problem at that point to back off to six months? Once we know what we're doing, what's the plan, and it's been established?
You mean later come in and change?
So later come in and change it down to 6 months?
Not at all. Not at all. Say we did a year, and after a year of operation, and sometime in 2019, you say, hey, it's working. We see how it's doing it. We're ready to move it down to 6 months. You can change that at any time.
Okay, because what I hear you saying, if you really need the year from the get-go, just to get ourselves organized.
Yeah, you might want to say a year of service at the very beginning with the anticipation that after it's up and running, you may want to revisit that.
Okay. Two other just concerns about this topic is, number one, our employees, when they're hired, are on probation for 6 months. So that's a time when we tell people for them to see if this is a good fit and for us to see if they're a good fit.
Sure.
So at the minimum, I would say we wouldn't want to do any contributions until we make sure they're a good fit and they're going to be here beyond that 6 months. But we also have seen an unfortunate number of people leave us in the first year. And so that just really adds to the administrative burden to put people in, take them out, put people in.
That's an issue we need to work.
Absolutely.
We hire people. We're a hard survivor. You need to live in the first year. That's a management issue. We need to encourage people to stay.
But for tax purposes, we shouldn't be allowed at 6 months. It should be tax year as far as the individuals are concerned. In the long run, it's going to be more important that the year ends on the 31st of December as opposed to matching it with our fiscal year.
And I think how many a year of employment before the reality of 6 months?
So that was going to be my question to ask if I was a person then within that first year. And when they leave, they get to take whatever they paid in or whatever was paid out for them. They take that with them.
You're not saying anything
in the first year.
After they start contributing, they will generate a balance. And that's one of the questions, I think it's question number three, is vesting. So they can always take their money, even if they only put in three times, say. When they leave, they can always take their money. But one of the questions to be answered is, how long do they have to work here before they can also take the city's share?
So your vesting period is a lot less than some of the other places.
5 years is what our current pension plan is, and also what the state of South Carolina's pension plan is. That's what. But we're not at that one yet. We're still on eligibility. I didn't know if Joel or Ben or Aaron had anything to add on eligibility.
Well, I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. So there's employee contribution and employer contribution. Okay. Employer contribution is in addition to the regular salary. It's not like the full figures that we can break regular salary. Does the employee contribution and the employer contribution both have to start on the same day, or do you just say that you can start the employee can start contributing sooner than the employer does?
I'm going to let Aaron answer that one, is how people generally would handle that if they would have a different date of contribution for the employer and employee.
Sure. So, hello everybody. This is Aaron with Women in Power. Thank you, first of all, for having me here today. Generally, what I've seen for plans like this is that the employer and employee contributions into this plan would start at the same time.
Okay. So we were talking about initially a January 1st, 2018 beginning date. It was 1 year before those employees would be eligible. So anybody that started on or after January 1st, 2018 would start getting money put into a pension account.
Defined contribution. The new plan.
Right. On January 1st, 2019.
Of the first payroll period ending after January 1st, 2019.
But if at that time we decided to switch it to 6 months, in other words, Dick had suggested that we might downgrade the service period required 6 months from a year. If people start on January 2nd, 2019, and they can start contributing only in 6 months, whereas these people have to wait a full year. That's correct. So in one respect, we would disadvantage some versus others.
Well, if you did not do the plan, they'd still have to wait a year before they went into the
current.
So, question of whether it's disadvantaging. If you say, well, we want to do 6 months, and we want to do 6 months from the beginning, I think you're looking at a January 1, 2019 implementation date.
Okay?
Because we got to get the record team.
As long as you're doing that, we might as well. The next council might as well go and decide if they prefer 6 months or maybe a year or whatever. But I think it's just better to go ahead and decide what's wrong rather than say, we'll do it this way, see how it goes, and change it.
Well, the reason I made my comment was at the beginning that we need a year. Mm-hmm. That's what we're being told. We need a year to get it started.
Right.
So once we get it started,
That's the ramp-up administrative strain
in
the year, but after that...
We need to attract people to become employees of the city of Edmonton. People might consider that to be an attractive recruiting portion of my program. So that was my rationale when I felt that you were making that.
I have several questions, and I don't want to jump ahead, but I want to ask all my questions at once. Question that I've been asked by the general public. What's wrong that we need to fix with our current system? What is wrong with the current plan that we need to fix?
That is a question for you to answer. It is, I was given the instructions that the council wanted to stop having a defined benefit plan, that the council did not like the liability associated with the defined benefit plan, and that it wanted to move to a defined contribution. I mean, this goes to the basic question of a policy matter.
Then you're not going to answer that. Dick, I think you were
calling it.
What is broken that we need to fix?
Well, nothing's broken. You can continue to keep the same plan forever and ever. You can have a high cost. You got people, it's loaded, quite frankly, to the higher end of the salary scale.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at current retirees and how much they're making, and some are making an obscene amount given that they didn't put a penny in for 20 or 30 years, and some are making an minuscule amount. In my opinion, given their contribution.
Okay, so that brings my second question. If I'm making, we're paying some employees just above minimum wage. It's not a living wage. So if I'm making $200 a week or $240 a week based on my salary, and I'm here for a year, I'm going to have to put 6% taken away from my $240. That I'm making, that's going to subtract from that. That money that I'm giving to this VC plan is going to be used to invest and get some return. That employee with a family of three to four is taking home less money every week. A year, you're going to start matching me on my funds.
You're going to start matching when the employee starts.
Okay, you can start matching, but I'm still taking on less. What I'd like to see us do, I'm at the low end of the pay scale, for us to increase our wages a bit above for those individuals, and I don't know how we do that successfully when we're giving, when we're nursing treatment to one sector that's the low income, that's not making a living wage, but we need to adjust our pay scale. I'm not saying, I'm skipping that talk, paying them $30 an hour to collect garbage, but somehow we've got to make adjustments to their salary.
Might I respond to both of your
questions?
Yes, sir. The first question that you ask is what's broken. And because of your leadership and the leadership of council members in the past, nothing's broken.
Okay.
Whereas pension plans around the country are in fiscal crisis, we're not one of those. So why are we doing this? We're doing it because we are cognizant of the fact that when you compare our pension system to pension systems around the country, it is extraordinarily generous. Extraordinarily generous. Now, our plan is extraordinarily generous in states that aren't so averse to raising taxes. Even in states that are not averse to raising taxes, our plan is extraordinarily generous. I mean, you would have to look long and hard to find a plan that is so generous. So you might say, well, that's a good thing. We should be proud of that. The fact is, though, I'm not believing as your city manager that we are going to wave a wand and all of a sudden not be averse to raising taxes. So the question is, what is our financial position going to be? What financial condition are we going to be in 10 and 20 and 30 years? We're doing this because we are supportive of proper financial planning. This is a plan we can't afford. And it'll become more and more obvious as we are in need of more and more employees. We're dealing with the property management issue, for example, and the first thing that's said is we need 3 or 4 more employees. Well, that's not unique to Mike Jordan and his department. We're going to continue to see that. We'll hear the need for more police public safety officers in the future. And this is about positioning the city so that in 20 or 30 years we're in a better position. But doing it without killing our employees. That's why in the first instance we have recommended in the strongest of terms that existing employees be exempt, because I think that you made a compact. You made an agreement, you made a promise to them that if they accepted employment here, that they knew what the wage was going to be and they knew what the pension plan was going to be. You don't have to go that far in North Augusta, the county system. Their employees are all contributing. Our public safety officers have contributed for years. The requirement that employees contribute is commonplace to have employees contribute to the pension. And so nothing's broken because of wise decisions that you made in the past, but we're looking forward. We know that there's a huge deficit out there called infrastructure. That's hundreds of millions of dollars. We haven't even scratched the surface. We're talking about having phase two of that be most, hopefully, of the CPSD4. But that will only scratch the surface. When we get into this infrastructure thing, if we're going to do it properly, we're going to be in it for hundreds of millions of dollars over 20 or 30 years. And we have to position ourselves. Something's got to give. And the question is, are we a community where there is a possibility or a likelihood that a new council is going to come on and love to raise taxes? I don't think that's going to happen. I just have a feeling that that's not going to happen. And so the question is, can we do something for the long-term fiscal stability of our city that doesn't hurt existing employees in a way that is similar to what has absolutely been happening for the last 20 years in the private sector, and now more and more is happening in the public sector? The plan that we have right now, I mean, if we were swimming in dough, had no huge liabilities, then we probably wouldn't be talking about this. But our job, the job of our finance director, the job of your city manager, the job of your management team, is to try to position the city so that in 10 or 20 or 30 years we're in a better position, not in a worse position. And to continue down the road of not addressing kind of like the 800-pound elephant in the room, which is the cost and the liability of our pension plan, I think would be irresponsible. The second issue that you raised...
Let me just respond to you first. You reply to you first. First of all, given the millions and millions of dollars that we're going to have to use for infrastructure replacement, we're not going to solve that with a pension plan dollars. We're going to have to face raising taxes at some point in time, like it or not.
And I think if the taxpayers understand where those monies are going, they will be, you're not going to get 100%, never, with any decision we've had, have we got 100% approval. But I think they will understand that this town has a major role in infrastructure improvements. And some consideration has been given. The school district's been successful at doing that. It takes education along with transparency to get that done. But my key concern, I was only asking the question because the question that raised to me, what is, what's broken that we need to, and it was in a kind way that that question was asked to me. Secondly, the other question regarding the, those folks that were not paying a living wage.
And that is as a legitimate issue as the first question you raised. But my response to that would be that is a legitimate issue to be raised when we're talking about overall compensation.
Okay.
We're working to finalize a compensation plan that does exactly what you're talking about, and that is recognize the lowest paid employees where there is big turnover. You know, talk to Tim Coakley, and I mean, he can't keep drivers for our vehicles or whatever. That's right, or the county or the private sector. That is a compensation issue that we are addressing in the compensation plan. I'm not saying that it's not a legitimate one, but that needs to be addressed in and of itself, that we have people that are barely getting a livable wage that we need to address.
But I really don't know how they make it on what they're being paid right now. Sometimes they're surviving with families.
The question that comes up, though, about eligibility, can a person opt out of the program fully? You cannot. Okay. My next question is going to be, if you opt out initially, what would it cost them to buy back in?
It's a mandatory contribution. It's a condition of employment. You must complete 6%.
Or whatever.
Or whatever level you select.
Is the age of 21, so you're not going to hire anybody out of high school. Usually 18 is the legal one. It's been 21. Huh? It's currently 21, but...
It's currently 21 in the plan, but you can put whatever age you want to.
Well, I guess it's in asking the panel, if you will, what is the reason for that 3-year gap? There's got to be some kind of reason. We're hoping that work for somebody to get trained or something. There's got to be a reason behind
it. Aaron, do you
want to
weigh in on what you see most of your other clients? Aaron, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I'm here. I don't know that I can speak to the age, the physical age, for eligibility. It's not something that I've ever really taken a personal hand or someone survey on. I can certainly look and take it and then take that as a takeaway. And get back to y'all, but at this point, I don't know that I can say 18 or 21 most commonly.
Not sure. Probably higher turnover than most.
Well, employees. You know, you've got, if you want somebody to start out of high school, you're going to have them. It's just a thought process.
You know, the answer to the problem in the beginning was it's 21, because that's what it was when we started our plan way back then. There's a lot of things that are different from way back when. I mean, I see no reason why it shouldn't be 18 or, for that matter, 17. I mean, I think we got away from the school district, and, you know, I was 16 after high school, but that's extraordinary. But probably by 18, 50, they're going to graduate. Most people are going to be 18.
And you're correct, because given what the school systems are doing now, some students are getting as much as 2 years of college while they're in high school. And they're 18 years old, they're 20 when they're completing their degree, and they still can't participate because if we'd be using the 21 as a magic number.
If I didn't work the age of 18, you know, they would be employed. That's just a question.
As far as the city's insurance, so do we have the liability for employees under 18 or under 21?
And they would cover the same amount of
drivers?
It doesn't speak to age.
Okay, so it's not insensitive.
No.
What is the salary of our lowest paid employee in the city?
I've been looking at hourly, so let me think. We have what we call facilities assistants, and they're just about, you know, cover at 10, what, for an
$9.
Most of them are not full-time, but if they were full-time, they'd be $19,156.
It's a shame that we couldn't set up something so they wouldn't have to pay 6% of their salary if they were under a certain salary level. Because that they could wrong. Exactly.
So, Aaron, familiar with that? That's an interesting concept. Is Aaron familiar with any cities that do that?
With a tiered structure based on their salary?
Didn't you say they were part-time?
No, in terms of the employee's required contribution, no, but in a plan like this, generally, you have to keep it
consistent.
In terms of the percentage across the board, generally speaking, or else you get this what are called testing issues, and that's a whole other thing.
The state requires higher than that firm.
And I did want to just add this one comment about this discussion is I mentioned probation, and so during that time when people are on probation, if it's decided that they're a good fit and we're going to keep them, currently the salary plan states that they'll get a 5% increase at 6 months. So it doesn't 100% cover, but because the 5% is on their gross and the 6% that we're contemplating for contribution is pre-tax, it would be very close to a net zero.
Well, that again, something we could consider in the budget process. We can make it a 6% when they come off the probation if we wanted to, and then that's...
Or you could make this a 5%.
Sure.
You have to make this a 6%. Well, can I ask you a question, and maybe we'll really answer this. Does the employee and employer contribution have to match exactly? Does it have to be 66, 55, 44, or different?
Now, the way we developed the recommended contribution was we looked at national studies of what level of contribution is necessary to provide an adequate retirement income. That's a whole separate discussion. And what the best practices recommendation by many people was that a total contribution of 12% was needed over a working career to provide what was considered an adequate retirement income. And we just split it 50-50.
Okay. So, but I'm not sure if that answered my question. If in the wisdom of counsel, they said that the employer should contribute 8% and the employee should contribute 4%, can it be set up that
way? Oh, yeah, so, there's no requirement.
Can the employee opt to contribute more than 4%?
No. No, it is. No, there is.
But there is the state.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there is.
So they can have more without pre-tax going into that state.
They can choose.
403.
We have a
401k. Yes.
With the state of South Carolina, the city participates in their deferred compensation plan, where they have options. Employees have options for a 401k, a 457, and a Roth.
Yeah. Could you remind us what a new employee is required to contribute to the county of North Augusta?
Just over
8%.
And it's set by the state retirement
almost
board.
Almost 9%. It's gone up to 9% now. Soon enough, they're close to it.
So that was the next category. The next category was, where did the 12% come from? And that's one just to answer that. That is what is believed by the experts to be necessary so that one retires, they have an adequate.
Is it mandatory on the defined contribution plan that the employee can do anything?
No.
So you have zero and all of the unemployers that?
Yes.
So the employer put in 6% would strongly encourage the employees at their option to take advantage of the 401k, a little Roth, and so forth for their side of 6%.
Yes.
They 12% would have an option rather than being forced.
That's right. You could do a 6%. You could just do a straight defined contribution plan with a 6% city contribution and no employee contribution and tell them it's only going to provide half their retirement income. If they want retirement income, they better save through the state retirement system.
I'm not even advocating for it. I'm just learning. But it's just a matter of whether we
if it becomes mandatory to withhold it, would it be a mandatory contribution on their part, or whether they take it as an option?
The only way you can get a pre-tax contribution in a city-defined contribution plan is using a mandatory employee contribution that is fixed at a percentage level and cannot go be, and the employee has no control over doing more or less.
My preference would be the former, basically, if there was great concern about employees and their ability or willingness to contribute money back in their own check, one central solution would be set it up where only there's an employer contribution side, no employee contribution side, to let them then take advantage of
the rest. What would the employer side?
If the employer is, if we come to calculations right now, where we'd be paying 6% on the money, I'm not advocating this, I'm just describing a scenario. But the employer of the city can put in 6%. And we can give them every lecture, every sales pitch, everything in the world, so you know, also I'll take 6% and put it into this. That's your option. The self-directed means to try to ensure and guarantee your retirement. And that way they at least have that choice. So if they're a person making $9 an hour, most of them are part-time, so may not be able to live away depending upon the decisions they want to make. But if they were only making that $9 an hour and they still couldn't afford to take 6% out of that, and it's pre-tax, so it's a very small amount of money difference, but if that's what they determined they wanted to do, they wouldn't have to put 6% anywhere. But they would, anyone and everyone that was an employee is eligible for that state plan, they put 6% or more in those programs.
But Aaron could address this from a national standpoint, but there's a reason why when municipalities and the private sector put together pension plans that they have mandatory requirements. The very people that you talk about that you're saying can't afford it would probably be the folks that aren't putting 12% aside. Right. What we know is, we know the last chapter of that book. They retire and they don't have enough money to live on. And I don't think we should be encouraging that.
And we know too nationally very few people put it away.
No question about it.
And to answer the question, the state of South Carolina requires their employees to contribute 9%. That would be an employee of the county, if you want to guess, of the state. And if you're a police officer, it's 9.75%.
So if we went with the 6 and 6, we'd still have a competitive advantage for an employee that's contemplating going to North Augusta or to the county.
They're going to North Augusta or the county, they have a pension system.
They
would have to find them.
They would have to find
them. Jack, can you address the kinds of part-time employees that we have in the city of Athens? Generally speaking, we know we have cadets, we probably have a lot of people in Parks and Rec.
Parks and Rec has a lot of what we call these facilities assistant. They are at the lowest pay scale in finance. We have accounts receivable clerks. Most of the girls.
You said something about Patty. She's part-time.
Most of the girls that you see collecting the money are part-time.
Define part-time. How many hours a week are they working? Are they full-time for like 3 months, and then we don't need it anymore?
No, less than.
How many hours a week, or whatever?
Less than the 34 hours.
You have to be 40 hours
to be considered full-time.
Tell you what, is it a measure of 2 weeks?
We get paid bi-weekly.
Yes, so it's a measure of 2 weeks. Am I wrong?
It's 40 hours a week for full-time.
Okay, so I thought it was a measure of 2 weeks.
A lot of the facilities assistants might work 20 hours. My girls generally work 25 hours, but we could have somebody working 30 hours. And they'd still be considered part-time.
If somebody's working like 20 or 25 hours a week, does the 1 year eligibility for vesting count, or does that person have to accumulate a certain amount, like 2,020 hours for a full-time employee for a year?
And
that the same? Right now it's 28 years, they can't be able to pay
that. Right, we would have to consider them full-time, is the way it was drafted, but that's a question.
No part-timer, less than 40 hours?
Well, that's a subject that I'm raised. If you tell me that we've got somebody who's doing a good job for us and only working 20 hours a week, I don't see any reason why they shouldn't get a number on their plan.
or 30 hours at that time. That's why I asked what kind of employees are we talking about. If they're regularly working 20 or 28 or 32 hours a week.
That's as opposed,
and as opposed to people that just come on, you know, for short periods of time.
Would they be tested in 1 year or is it a total 2,000 and whatever?
The way the plan is written and the way the defined benefit plan works, because it only covers full-time people, we use what's called an elapsed time system. You're here a year later, you get 1 year of service. We're not counting hours. If you go to part-time people, we might have to start counting hours of service if you want. Or we can use the same lifetime. You're here a year later, you get a year of vesting service regardless of your hours. So we can handle it several ways once you make a decision.
I'd like to have that over.
It'd be nice to give everybody everything. All this stuff costs money.
Right. And firstly, I think it's more manageable, easier if you work with full-time employees. That crowds it.
Well, do we have any, quote, part-timers that are like specialists, you know, that are always on call, so to speak, like 20 hours a week? I mean, that's their contract, their guarantee?
On call?
Lisa Hoffman, part-time over at Oak Crest. And we have to
join us. Part-time.
Like,
that's part-time.
Special.
We have the Roach. Dirt roads horse?
Yeah, he's a retiree. He works part-time to do the dirt roads. Richard Mixon and Pete Cromer basically share a position. They're both part-time to be the zoning official. Wendell Hall does part-time business license inspection, so he's out there 2 to 3 days a week trying to find people doing business.
And earlier, Lee Gallagher, Pete from the public, for example, and Wendell Hall comes from public safety, so they can come into our city system is not a problem. But if we have somebody that's retiring from our system, I guess it's our system, so we can make that a little more.
Well, is there, like Pete from it, do we have to come in under the contribution portion? He has to be just like a new employee, basically.
He's already taking advantage of benefits, isn't he?
He's a retiree.
Right.
Okay. He's in the
county as
well?
Yeah. He's
a Hollywood. So, the body's sort of saying, these folks work for us, they retire for us with their benefits, and now we're trying to fix a system that is not, we can make it work, but do we have the folks on staff to try to make it work?
This is the time to ask you questions.
Well, I had a question. I didn't think this was going to have nearly this much consternation about it, but so as long as we're starting from sort of ground zero, what is the eligibility and or reason against a 401k plan as opposed to a contribution plan?
You cannot have a 401k. Your government entities are not
because the regulation is not covered. Not under the chapter 401k, it's under something else.
Well, you can do a 457 plan.
Okay.
You can do a 457 plan if you wanted to. But it was totally direction you're supposed to go with.
No, this is what I did.
With a defined contribution approach. Government entities, the only government entities that can have 401k plans are ones that have had grandfather plans. So the state of South Carolina, but no new government entity can adopt a 401k plan as a
457, how is it different?
It used to be different, but today you can operate them almost like 401k.
I think the county government offers to a lot of their...
You don't have to participate. It's not.
If it's a 457 plan, then the contributions by the employees could be voluntary. And now you're talking about completely different.
Yeah.
Whole thing. But if what you want is a replacement for your defined benefit plan, saying we want to provide an actual retirement benefit for our new employees that we hire. And we want to make sure that if they stay here, when they get to retirement, as John said, that they have enough money. This is the best approach, a mandatory employee contribution with a fixed employer contribution to assure that when they reach retirement, they have enough money. You're going to find with the 457 down the road, you're going to look at it and say, these people don't have enough account balances. They're not contributing enough. You know, just like John said. I think that your approach is this plan. What you're trying to do, I think, is replace the defined benefit plan with a comparable retirement plan that provides an adequate benefit. I think you're going to need a mandatory employee contribution to do that.
And that's why I started prefacing my comments with saying I didn't know that we've been pretty much.
Otherwise, you'll find yourself in the same position that the private sector finds itself in, is that unless people save, they're not going to have enough retirement. And you can't force them to save.
I have a question. What's the annual cost right now to support our contribution plan?
It's about $1.2 million. And that's the contribution that's budgeted.
So what's the percent of our budget is?
That's across all our funds, so it's less than
1%. Yeah, so
it's across the $26.5 million or something like that.
Do you have any projections based on
that? I didn't ask a question. We have projections over the next 5 and 10 years.
It's 5%.
Well, you have to include water
and sewer
somewhere.
That's in the 20s.
Ben, on the phone is our actuary. Ben?
What's the question here?
Okay. Our mayor is asking a question about a projection forward on our defined benefit plan, and they do actuarial contribution calculation every year.
Right.
Do you want to handle how far in the future that's valid?
Well, I know you're asking the energy stuff that you know goes to 40 years out. I think I feel uncomfortable doing that just because there's so many assumptions that we're kind of thinking have to work together. I like to focus more on a 10 to 20 or 25 year approach. So we have looked at that. I mean, it is showing an increase in, I don't have it in front of me. Do you happen to have it with you, Tim? So we have looked at that.
I know when we looked at going out 30 years, I think we said if we looked at the plan over the next 40 years to go to this plan would save us about $10 million. Because this plan will not disappear. Our costs and liability will not go to zero until the last person that is involved in the defined benefit plan ceases. So it could be 50 years, it could be 45 years, it could be 60 years. Everyone at this table could say how long they think it'll be, and Ben might be closest to right, but anybody could be right as far as when that last person is going to pass away, basically. So there'll be a contribution.
The amount we put in varies as the rate of return on our investment.
Absolutely. There's a lot of variables.
Yeah. Well, this year it was down to $1.2 million, but it has been over $2 million. When we had the negative, it was probably way higher.
Yeah, we talked about that recently, about that fluctuation.
I don't believe it was ever over $2
million. It was very close.
Of course, I don't have that book with me.
What do we estimate? What do we estimate the return on our pension fund?
Our assumption is 7.75, Ben.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
That's
the next category.
Well, are we going to try to get an actual annuity?
Well, I'm just saying you really, I'm surprised, especially in today's atmosphere, to rule out somebody that's graduating from high school that's participated in some other program that makes them available. You know,
if you can hire permanent people out of high school, or maybe have out of the something there, they're going to be permanent, I would say use age 18. So age 18, I'm comfortable with on that.
I think so too.
Does the probationary period count towards eligibility period?
Yes.
Yes.
Now, I do think if you have it as the eligibility requirement as years and you later change it to 6 months, at least whoever the last report is going on in 1 year, 6 months.
Well, what happens if you change it to 6 months, anyone who has 6 months at that time would come in? What about part-time people? What was that? I felt like consensus that you were not going to include part-time people.
It's too complicated.
What about one year of service is okay with everybody, right?
Well, that costs half a million.
Yeah.
Well, not if you don't postpone this initial start date, doesn't have to be.
Well, he still does. If you postpone it to July 1, if you do less than 1 year of service, you're looking at 1 year of service, you can do, I think, reasonably do July 1 of 2019. Okay. I'm sorry, 2018. Yeah. Otherwise, you're looking at January 1 of 2019.
I mean, this is going to be Andrea and Ed and those are the decisions.
No, I think 1 year is probably right. There's no commercial and 3 years.
You do have these turnover, and if you solve your turnover problems, then you might want to look at changing that. But right now, you have pretty heavy turnover.
And the problem is with every board decision, it changes numbers, and the only numbers we run projections on are based on these scenarios right now. In 1 year, part-time. Right now, the projections are based on people playing one and over. But I don't expect we hire tons of people under age 21. So I don't have to make a big sort of material difference in those numbers.
Well, what is under the current system, what is the retirement calculation in the last 3 years?
The calculation? Is there less? Average final compensation for the last 3 years. Yes, sir.
Well, does that actually include people on salary or people on hourly rates? Because my understanding is some people really gain the system.
Overtime does not count.
You don't do that?
No, you use base pay.
Okay, good.
But this
place is
that
they don't offer it with overtime and all that kind of stuff. You know,
well, best of my knowledge, you've not increased anyone's salary rapidly back the year. Sometimes you see that too. I've not done that. So it's base pay last 3 years.
Clarification on a comment, Kim, that you made.
I'm trying to ask this question.
Okay. Go ahead. Well, I believe you just asked a question. You made a comment regarding return on the pensions, and that was 7.5 million. And that's without investment on this plan, is that right? Or our current plan?
On the current plan, then does the actuarial contribution each year, we make the assumption of 7.75.
Okay.
When we did the example last time, I think we used 7%.
For the return, for the projections in the defined contribution, 7%.
Okay.
No, I've asked this before, just for clarification purposes. This money is going to be in the individual's name. There's no way the citizen started using that as a...
No, it'll be in a trust. It'll be held in trust. That individual's have accounts with, and they'll be able to direct the investments of their money, but the city can never access this money.
Yeah. This is probably an HR question that you said that we have a high turnover rate
but people who leave with less than 1 year of service. What are the major reasons that they're leaving? Is it salary? Is it they look for a position that's a little bit more convenient to where they live, or is it because they're just totally satisfied with the city, dissatisfied with the work environment? What are the reasons?
I can probably answer more holistically, but the ones I'm aware of, it's usually the workers, the drivers who now they have enough, you know, they got a few months experience with us, now they can go get a job, they get $2.
That's
absolutely
correct. What is the city's turnover rate right now?
When we looked at this back, when did we start looking at this one?
Yes.
It's been almost 6 months. We had, from beginning to a year later, about half the people were dropping off. But, you know, you can do turnover a lot of different ways. You cannot count blue collar.
How about blue collar?
I don't have. I mean,
we give an HR report. We're behind a couple of months on it. We get an HR report of all the hires and terminations from the different departments. It includes temporary people, which I don't count for my calculations, but it's higher than it should be.
Well, how many employees do we have, and how many days? Offhand, John, you should probably know this. If you have like 280 or 320 employees, how many are within that first year, and how many just kind of ballpark figure?
When you look at that
first year dropped out,
a lot of them are part-time, or they're at the lower end of the scale, without experience. So they come to work for the city, just like Leslie said. So they learn to drive the truck, they learn to, or they're a park and rec employees that are working to take a part-time job, not because they wanted a part-time job, but because they need a job. And then something comes up and we lose it.
Can you give us, John, an updated HR report in our next guide?
Yes.
Now we're in the contribution level. I mean, we have to have a decision about what contribution rate should be by the city and by the employees. And by the studies by independent people are that a 12% contribution over a 35-year working career with various assumptions of interest, mortality, tables, and stuff is what's needed to provide an adequate retirement income. 10%, you're all at 10% contribution, you're probably off, you know, you're 10% under. A 14% contribution, you're 10% over. I recommend it to John and Kim that a 12% contribution, that would be a plan that at that rate you could look any new employee in the eye and say, we are giving enough money into your plan, and all the experts say that this will give you adequate retirement if you stay with the city.
When Warner presented that to staff, our concern was, first of all, 12%. We want to make sure that the combination of the employer and the employee contribution is adequate for a pension at the end of someone's career. Secondly, we asked Empower, who administers pension plans all over the country, whether or not a 50-50 split is unique, or whether they see that a lot, and we were told that that is common. Thirdly, I wanted to compare it to North Augusta and to the county for obvious reasons. So I thought that if we're the formula equals 12% and is similar to pension plans all over the country where there's a 50-50 split, and it's less than the county in North Augusta, so that positions us well.
Keep in mind that that's also assuming there'll be Social Security that will supplement.
That is assuming, 12% is assuming Social Security. Without Social Security, it's more like 18 to 20%.
And I think Ben can talk to that too. Ben, are you there? Talking about the rationale for doing the 12% And the split of six and six.
But I'm checking everything that I'm hearing from the power and water. The 50-50 split is just very much what we're seeing in the best practice of really the way the evolution of of equal sharing, not having, having an equal sharing in your retirement benefits for employees for employers, employees. And it is in line with what's been in Social Security. When you get into the 12% again, based on the studies, that 12% is the total number. Obviously, you can be divvied up however the council feels, but everything that we're seeing in the trends and the way things are pointing to the equal sharing is just, individual responsibility kind of being more to the forefront than it was, maybe 30 or 40 years ago.
The only gap in this whole concept is it assumes that you're going to work until you're 62 when you can start collecting Social Security.
The numbers actually assume 65.
65, which is important. I can't think of a city employee in kind of those in my 10 years in the council that retired at 65.
Plenty of them do. We just had one retire,
but they were 66.
Most of them.
Most of them, okay. Most that I've seen are younger than that, with 30 or 35 years of beginning the plans.
That's their decision. They work on it.
But then again, some of them will retire and take other jobs.
And some of them may contribute another 4 or 5% to the state's 401k plan or 457 plan. They may be able to afford to retire. It's going to be individual decisions really based on what their retirement is.
And that's a good point. We're doing the best we can. Talk to me about that relationship between Social Security and age 62 for retirees. How does that work?
Dan? The 62 year age Social Security and our pension?
Yeah, current pension.
Oh, the current pension.
Yeah.
If somebody is less than 62, they can still retire if they qualify at age 55. One of their forms of payment that they'll be offered, which are all actuarially equivalent, then, could include a Social Security advance. So just explain how you calculate, Ben. He's asking about the current calculation. He's asking about the current plan and what their forms of payment are.
Well, they get it earlier than, let's say, 62. Or they get it, let's say, at age 50, then we give them something to do with Social Security. And then does that end at age 62?
Okay, so I guess Candy is asking about that Social Security level enough to make it.
Yes, they have to be 55. They can't retire at 50.
Right. But that does there is an option that, and I think it is used, I don't have it in front of me how frequently this is, but we do see it, 2 or 3 times a year at least, so where what their benefit is that they've earned in their lifetime. It's bumped up for right now, but until you're reaching Social Security retirement age, to take into account that once you do that and draw that, you're leveling it out. So there is more upfront money to that individual from the pension plan, but then it's lower, it's offset by what they will be getting when they are Social Security normal retirement age.
Would you define Social Security normal retirement age?
It cuts at 62. It cuts at 62. So to the people whose normal retirement age is 66, at 62 they have to go claim Social Security or not, but their pension is cut at 62.
That's what I want.
not to be the worst, but what about if the person passes away? Then we're in a hole as far as moving forward with the level of Social Security retirement.
Well, we're not in a hole
because
if they die, then we don't pay them anymore.
How do they make up for that, what we've subsidized since age 55?
You're not subsidizing it. It is an economic equivalent benefit. It's actuarial payments. When someone retires, what the plan provides is that they have a lifetime benefit of a dollar amount based on their years of service and salaries. So let's just assume that they would be entitled to a lifetime benefit of $1,000 a month. So one option is I can take $1,000 a month, and you're going to pay me for my life, and when I die, you cease paying me. You look at actuarial payments, but they say, but I have a spouse. So I want a benefit that will provide me money, and then upon my death will provide a 50% survivor benefit to my spouse. So then looks at the actuarial tables, the interest rates, and makes a calculation. That $1,000 a month equivalent, I'm just going to throw numbers, I don't mean anything, might be equivalent to a $750 benefit for your life, and then a $375 benefit for the life of your spouse based on your current ages and a new mortality tables. Similarly, on the Social Security side, when he looks at it and says, okay, we've got $1,000 a month for life, so I can pay you $1,500 a month for the next 5 years, and then after 5 years, I'm only going to pay you $600 a month. But that, if you look at the annuity tables, that is the actuarial equivalent if you live to your life expectancy. Now, if you die, it is. So it is an actuarial equivalent. And you're right, if someone lives and dies on the day they've turned 62, they got a little more than that $1,000, but it's the actuarial equivalent of that. You still are coming out ahead. You can pay it, but the life expectancy is going to 80 something, you know. But it is an economic equivalent benefit that's calculated using life expectancy tables and interest rates.
What about survivor benefits? What's been brought up for? Is there a survivor benefits capability under the current system?
No, under your current plan, every person who retires has an election to take their benefit in various forms of payment. Okay? And all of those forms of payment, include survivor benefits, but they're all the economic equivalent of each other. The plan does not subsidize any particular form of benefit.
Can I ask this question if you want to?
Sure.
You mentioned a table. And this question, the reason I posed this question is a matter of recruiting and retention. Is there a table, can you put together a table that gives a 6% investment based on salary, whatever salaries we use, and then the city's 6% or whoever is putting in the other 6%, that over a period of time I can see that my money has worked for me and I'm getting this?
Let Empower, because Empower has tools on their websites that will allow people to go in and put in rates of contribution that will show them what they'll have at various ages.
Okay. We had a brief example that you did for us, Ben, in the presentation last time, so I displayed that on the screen. This scenario was a $30,000 salary, contributing the 6% and assuming an interest rate of 7%, and if the employee works 30 years, their account balance, including both percentage match and their contribution, would be $432,000. $1,000 at their age 65, which would convert to an annual amount of $32,389. And at that point, they were making $53,000, assuming a 2% salary increase, which is a 61% replacement. That was an example. But some of the things in yellow, each of those can be changed.
Right.
You can say, no, we want to assume 6% interest, but we want to have a 5% contribution, whichever way.
Okay.
It's good. Several of the other items that were asked to be answered are yes.
So we're at 6%.
Is everyone comfortable with the 6%
and 6%? Looking at a 5-year vesting plan, which is really 4 years of participation. So we can ask four others of the panel to address that. There also was a discussion of an option to allow new employees or young employees a one-time option if they want to choose to go into the defined contribution plan as opposed to staying in the defined benefit.
Current employees.
You want to address
that? Yes. You frequently may have some younger employees who are saying, look, I'm young. I think my account balance is going to grow. I like the defined contribution plan for many number of reasons, and we're going to allow them a one-time option to elect to leave the defined benefit plan, move to the defined contribution plan, and take the cash of their accrued benefit, and it will go into the defined contribution plan as their beginning balance. There are about 85 people who would qualify. What we had suggested was using people with less than 2 years of service, anyone less than age 35 and less than 10 years of service, and any people, that would be less than 2 years of service or age 35 and less than 10 years of service. So we're about 85 people.
Yeah. Well, this is under the rules that I can't switch back. Once I've decided,
You're out.
Unless it's 401A, it's transferable to the next employer.
That's right.
The other plan, you got to wait till...
This would be a real advantage. If someone is thinking that they're not going to stay with Aiken until they retire and is qualified, they probably will do this because they'll move their accrued benefit in cash to their account balance. They'll be fully vested in it probably. And if they leave the city, they take that account balance with them. They can roll it over to an IRA or to another plan, do anything they want with it. While if they stay in the defined benefit plan and they leave, they will simply just get a monthly benefit commencing at age 65. I think this would be very attractive to them.
Yeah, it is very attractive. Devil's advocate, what about a person that worked for 9 years, the office of the plan? What are the mechanics of getting into the contributing plan instead of the defined benefits plan? How much is it costing? So basically, if it doesn't cost him anything, all of a sudden he has... You're basically giving them retirement benefits before he's retired.
Well, yes, that is true. If he quits, to get him, he has to leave the employment assistance. But that's anybody in the defined contribution plan. Every time you put in 6% of their...
The employees work for 15 years or more.
We're not going to do 15. We're only going to do 10.
It doesn't make any difference. Well, the example I was going to give is just a regular employee. He's going for the old plan, retirement. If he quits after 15, what does he get for retirement pay?
After 15? Depends on how old he is. If he's not eligible, he has to wait till he's 65, and then he gets a calculation based on his 15 years of service, his average final compensation. And
so
he'll get that at age 65.
The city of Aiken, once he hits 55 and you're eligible for his...
No, if you leave and you didn't qualify for early retirement, you have to wait for 65.
Okay. Well, somebody... Say somebody works here for 5 years, okay? He leaves.
He's fully vested. Okay. He's had 5 years of service.
65.
When he turns 65, he gets a pension. He gets a monthly pension based upon his 5 years of service and his compensation at his final 3 years of compensation at the time he left the city.
That's where
he's going.
It's tax qualified money that you can't take advantage of without penalty until you get over that.
That's a good benefit.
Once you've had 5 years of service in the city, you're going to receive a pension. Okay? If you leave, it may not be until 65, but you will receive a pension benefit. And it may be small.
Okay.
Keep in mind that everything we've been talking about is not the current employees who are on the second floor. We're talking about new employees.
And what will also be nice is it will give you a good base of employees. And if we don't do this, one of the reasons for the, I recommend the transfer, is you could all of a sudden have 50 or 80 people in the defined contribution plan from the beginning. Otherwise, you're going to have 5, 1 or 2 people, 3 or 4 at the end of the year. You may have 10. It'll make the plan more solid.
Okay. I missed the point. Let's say you work for 10 years or whatever. You offer a plan for the new plan. So you get some kind of calculation of what do you get for retirement pay when you turn 65. That money is given to you in your 20-year short retirement age. But that individual can take that money with them right then and there.
No, you made a mistake. What you get is what's called an accrued benefit. We would calculate your pension at 65 and discount it back to its present value.
And Dan, do you want to chime in on that? When these, if this decision is made to allow these people to make this choice, then we would have to have each of those individually calculated by the actuary. So, Dan, if you want to chime in on how that would work.
Right.
Practically.
We will calculate their accrued benefit that they had earned of what it initially was up to 118, but whatever the effective date is, we would calculate the present value of that.
But that's, I mean, if you want to invest in students, that's your decision.
Your data is against doing that.
So are we targeting July 1? That was our recommendation, that we not put a gun to your head and suggest that we need to pursue this, that we give you time. If you don't need it, that's fine, but we would need to know that in the next week as well.
I think that was must be our job to prepare to move forward, maybe individually check with the three members to see if they are, or if they feel like they need anything more.
If we did, I think the city would be better than
we are. That doesn't make any sense.
If you can make a decision like by December 1st, you know, then I would say that we could do it January 1, provided that committed to
unless our new members come in, you are all very uncomfortable as your very first act to be required to take a vote as significant as this.
I'm not going to take a vote on something that I've just been presented with since last Thursday. This was presented just on Thursday, but I mean, if we want to speak these things up, I'm more than open to meeting and dissecting this. I mean, and I thought through it, and I do have my own questions. I wasn't sure how involved I could get, to be honest with you, and I
was
since I'm not official yet, but I do have a set of questions, and I mean, I don't have a problem meeting and dissecting this. So we can speak
in long. I mean, I'd be very happy if in January and beginning of February we could try that.
Sure.
Wouldn't you?
I think that would be a very good timeline, but in order to do that, we need to rewrite the draft that we have to say we would start the implementation July 1, 2018.
Was everyone comfortable with the transfer option too? It seemed like y'all were.
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't bump
it under
a little bit. Yeah, I'd love to see an incentive for that transfer. Before you said you do the calculations, once we got a, whatever you call that, the person we're going to hire, because there may be a better word even more.
Well,
a better
buy
than chance.
This is a fine balance between moving money out of the defined benefit plan and moving too much money, which is why we use 10 years at age 35.
That's pretty much standard number.
That's the best we could do, just eyeballing it without spending a lot of your money on doing individual calculations.
So
we might find it to be 37 and a half and 12 years. I mean, you know, I think that that's a good number for myself.
Very good. Thank you.
Good. I want to thank our panel today. It's been very informative. Council certainly came prepared.
I'm just going to have one comment. I'm not sure I'm off the plan. I think 55 is actually under today's criteria of today's experience. It's actually a little bit too young to let people go over the top. I think we ought to move up to 60. I mean, you know, look around the table. And we're all, you know, sort of hale and hearty in order to
the defined benefit plan, the original, your current plan, was drafted to very much mirror the state's plan. Mm-hmm. And the state, we all know the problems with the state's plan, but that was the early retirement age under the state's plan. That's why it's there.
You have said a lot,
but
not in the
state
chapter.
Right, you didn't tell me that. Contrary.
I'm not going to go to, I'd say we're going to move 55 to 60 at least.
That's in the defined benefit plan.
It's not going to change the defined benefit plan. I'm not going to contribute.
No. There is no retirement age under the defined contribution plan. Whenever you terminate employment, you get your money. If you want to, you want to leave, and you can take your account balance. You want to leave at 50, or leave at 58, or leave at 68. Whenever you leave, you take your account balance.
If you could, you could leave your money in the city, continue the fast.
Oh, you could.
Yeah.
You could.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to take
it. I thought you took that option. But in fact, when you start going back to the actual aerial tables, like you said, when you calculate somebody that quits the program early,
that's only under the current plan. There'll be no actuarial tables under the defined contribution.
Well, how do you determine what that individual can take and put in a new 401?
He takes whatever his account balance is. It's an account balance plan. So he puts in his 6%, you put in 6%.
If you calculate what he can actually bring over from the...
One time.
The actuary will calculate that.
Okay. Is it the same if it's 55 or 60?
It'd be based on their age and years of service at whatever date you choose.
But then a very simple explanation, which is... It does not get into all the nuances that Ben does, but basically Ben will take their current years of service and take their current 3-year average compensation and calculate what their benefit would be at age 65, use his annuity tables to calculate a lump sum amount, and then discount that back to the current time. Yeah, and that's what they get as the actuarial, it's called the actuarial equivalent.
And hopefully, hopefully our seniors will manage that money as well.
Exactly. We're just trying to put a number on the true value of that annuity that doesn't start from 65. And put that in present value in today's terms as 1 month sum.
All right.
Very good. Thank you, everyone. That was something written by all three council members elect right here. Appreciate you.
Thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
Being here to be a part of that tonight. City Council will now go into a
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Aaron. We need a motion for council. At this time, council will go into executive session pursuant to section 30-478(1) of the South Carolina Non-Code for the discussion of persons regulated by city council specifically. The city council will go into executive session for the purpose of further discussion of the annual evaluations of the manager city attorney. Is there a motion?
Second.
Motion second. All those in favor?